I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said on Tuesday the United States is deeply concerned by the loss of life in an Israeli attack on a residential building in northern Gaza.
This was a horrifying incident with a horrifying result.
Gaza's health ministry said at least 93 Palestinians were killed and missing and dozens wounded in an Israeli strike on a residential building in the northern Gaza town of Beit Lahia on Tuesday.
It is another reminder of why we need to see an end to this war.
Israeli lawmakers have voted to ban the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, from operating within Israel, raising fears this will further worsen the already dire humanitarian situation in Gaza. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan reports.
The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees employs thousands of people who run the enclave's schools, its primary healthcare clinics, and other social services, as well as distributing humanitarian aid. Israeli lawmakers on Monday banned the agency from operating within Israel. The move raises concerns about UNRWA's ability to provide relief in Gaza and has alarmed Western allies who fund it. Since Israel launched its war following the October 7 attacks in 2023, nearly the entire Gazan population now relies on UNRWA for basics including food, water and hygiene supplies. The UN said in August that 9 UNRWA staff may have been involved in the October 7 attacks and fired them. Israeli authorities have long called for the agency to be dismantled, arguing it fosters anti-Israeli sentiment among its staff and in its wider social mission. UNRWA strongly disputes this characterization.
Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. This is VOA News. Russia test-fired missiles over distances of thousands of kilometers on Tuesday to simulate what it called a massive nuclear response to an enemy first strike. Russia has been signaling for weeks to the West that Moscow will respond if the United States and its allies allow Kyiv to fire long-range missiles deep into Russia. NATO said Monday that North Korea has sent troops to Western Russia, something Moscow has not denied. Thousands of Russians, including soldiers, have sought asylum in the West since Moscow's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, although only a fraction of their applications have been approved. However, France this month allowed several Russian army deserters to enter the country to seek refugee status, Henry Ridgewell reports.
Alexander, who does not want to give his family name for fear of political retaliation, was a soldier in the Russian army. He is now living in the French city of Cannes, along with his wife, Irina. In January 2022, as Russia was preparing its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Alexander was told his unit was heading to Russian-occupied Crimea for military exercises. He eventually managed to flee the army. A French court ruled in 2023 that Russians who refuse to fight can claim refugee status, but most are unable to travel overseas to lodge an asylum application. In a landmark case, France this month granted permission for Alexander and Irina, along with 8 other Russians, to enter the country and apply for asylum. The decision followed months of advocacy and campaigning by organizations like Russie Liberté, which encourage Russians to desert the army. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
Donald Trump is celebrating his weekend rally at Madison Square Garden, a rally that featured crude and racist insults. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Trump says there's never been an event so beautiful.
An absolute love fest, and it was my honor to be involved.
He's also used love fest to describe the Capitol riot. Speaking today at his Florida resort, Trump did not mention the event's racist comments about Latinos, Jews, Palestinians, or black people, nor sexual insults against Kamala Harris and Hillary Clinton, nor this.
There's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah, I think it's called Puerto Rico.
The Trump campaign distanced itself from the joke, but not the other comments. Sagar Magani, Washington.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
dozens killed in Gaza.
The house was bombed without prior warning. As you can see, martyrs here and there with body parts hanging on the walls.
Joe Biden weighs in on the presence of North Korean troops in Russia.
Mr. President, are you worried about the North Korean troops in forests in Russia?
I'm concerned about it, yes.
And bad news for trick-or-treaters this Halloween.
Blame elevated chocolate prices due to both pandemic-era supply chain snarls and a current cocoa bean shortage.
Today is Wednesday, October 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israel's military chief warned Iran on Tuesday to stand down from any retaliation for Israel's airstrikes near Tehran last week, which followed an Iranian missile barrage on October 1st.
If Iran does that mistake and sends another round of missiles to Israel...
That's the chief of the Israeli military general staff, Herzi Halevi. He said that if Iran were to launch another missile barrage at Israel, Israel would retaliate with more force than before. In Lebanon, at least 8 people were killed in an Israeli strike there that leveled 3 residential buildings to the ground. Israel has ramped up its airstrikes across Lebanon over the past month, saying it's targeting Hezbollah. Lebanese officials, rights groups, and residents say the strikes are indiscriminate. And in Gaza, after another of Israel's airstrikes, Palestinians rushed to a bombed-out house and sorted through bodies in a desperate search for survivors. Zachary Goldman of Reuters has the story.
Palestinians carried the wrapped bodies of victims after an Israeli missile strike on Tuesday shattered a 4-story building in Beit Lahia in the northern Gaza Strip. Gaza's health ministry said the building was packed with members of the extended Abu Nasser family, along with others displaced by the fighting. Ismail Uwaida said he was an eyewitness to the attack.
The house of the Abu Nasser family in Beit Lahia's project neighborhood was bombed. It's formed of 4 floors. There are tens of martyrs. Tens of displaced people were living in this house. The house was bombed without prior warning. As you can see, martyrs here and there with body parts hanging on the walls. The neighbors and everything in Beit Lahia, residents of Beit Lahia.
The health ministry said at least 93 people were dead or missing, and that 20 of those killed were children. There was no immediate Israeli military comment. Beit Lahia is among the northern Gaza towns and refugee camps ravaged by a new Israeli air and ground assault Palestinian medics say has killed around 900 people. The Israeli military has said the operations aim to prevent a revival of Hamas in the area after more than a year of bloody conflict. The war was sparked when Hamas-led militants killed around 1,200 people in a rampage across southern Israeli communities and took over 250 hostages on October 7, 2023, according to Israeli tallies. Israel has vowed no end to the war until it wipes out Hamas as a military force and governing entity in Gaza. Gaza's health ministry says the death toll from Israel's air and ground offensive has exceeded 43,000. Worries over the humanitarian crisis in Gaza worsened after Israel on Monday passed a law banning the United Nations agency known as UNRWA that coordinates relief for Palestinians in the occupied territories.
If UNRWA is unable to operate, it'll likely see the collapse of the humanitarian system in Gaza.
James Elder, a spokesperson for UNICEF, told reporters on Tuesday the decision would lead to more avoidable deaths.
So a decision such as this suddenly means that a new way has been found to kill children.
Israel said the move against UNRWA was due to what it said was evidence employees of the agency had aided and participated in the October 7th attack last year.
That's Zachary Goldman of Reuters reporting for us today. And now the war in Ukraine. On Monday, a Russian-guided bomb attack on Kharkiv shattered much of the Derzhprom building, one of the most celebrated landmarks in the city, dating from the 1920s. 6 people were injured in that attack, adding to the 13 wounded in an earlier pre-dawn attack on the city. The Derzhprom, or State Industry Building, was one of the most striking examples of Soviet-era constructivism architecture and was dubbed the Soviet Union's first skyscraper. It was on the tentative list of UNESCO World Heritage Sites. Meanwhile, the State Emergency Service of Ukraine released photos showing firefighters tackling a blaze at a damaged building following a strike in Kryvyi Rih, the hometown of Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky. In a caption accompanying the photos, the emergency service said one person was killed as a result of the missile attack launched by Russia. A three-story residential building, farm buildings, and a medical clinic were also damaged in the strike. On Tuesday at the Pentagon, spokesperson Major General Patrick Ryder addressed the issue of North Korean soldiers in Russia.
As we highlighted earlier this week, we believe that the DPRK has sent approximately 10,000 soldiers in total to train in eastern Russia, and that these troops will probably augment Russian forces near Ukraine over the next several weeks. A portion of those soldiers have already moved closer to Ukraine towards Russia's Kursk Oblast near the border with Ukraine, approximately a couple thousand, with a smaller number already present in the Kursk region. We remain concerned that Russia intends to use these soldiers in combat or to support combat operations against Ukrainian forces in Kursk. We continue to monitor closely and are consulting with our Ukrainian partners as well as other allies and partners.
President Joe Biden was also asked about the North Korean troops.
Mr. President, are you worried about the North Korean troops in Kursk, in Russia?
I'm concerned about it, yes.
Should the Ukrainians strike back?
Ukraine, yes.
At the moment, it's unclear if the United States and or NATO will support the use of weapons supplied by Western allies on North Korean forces on Russian territory. For his part, while attending a conference in Reykjavik, Iceland, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned that a lack of support for Ukraine, no matter who the next U.S. president is, would be a big win for Russian President Vladimir Putin, as he was asked to speculate on the outcome of the upcoming U.S. presidential election. Zelensky said he's relying on bipartisan support in Congress. Zelensky also commented on the presence of North Korean troops in Russia.
First of all, about North Korean soldiers, soldiers and officers, they have both. They have both already on Russian territory, and they will use it both. They will use it on our territory. 3,000 already on the territory of Russia, 3,000 of North Korean soldiers. We think the information from our intelligence, we think that they will have 12,000. This soon, I mean soon. It's not about years or months. It's soon. So that is the first. Of course, it's escalation. And how we can... sometimes I'm very surprised how our big partners, big strategic partners say that we should not cross red lines and escalate. But we think that Russia does it itself. So
Western leaders have warned that North Korea's involvement in a European war could also unsettle relations in the Indo-Pacific region, including Japan and Australia. Changing gears now to another world crisis. The International Organization for Migration warns that Sudan's displacement crisis is growing worse as the number of people fleeing fighting, hunger, and sexual abuse rises. IOM Director General Amy Pope reported that 11 million people are now uprooted from their homes, and more than 3 million refugees have fled to neighboring countries. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The war in Sudan, the world's largest displacement crisis, has uprooted more than 14 million people. The International Organization for Migration says 11 million have been displaced inside Sudan. This, says IOM Director General Amy Pope, is up by 200,000 just since September. Speaking from Fort Sudan, she tells journalists in Geneva the number of people who have fled across borders as refugees has increased to 3.1 million. She says more than half of those displaced are women, and more than a quarter are children under the age of five.
Unfortunately, many of them have been forced to flee repeatedly. They have little access to shelter. They have little access to livelihoods, and getting their basic needs met has been very, very difficult. The scale of the displacement and humanitarian needs are growing every day. Frankly, half of the population now needs help. People don't have access to shelter. They don't have access to clean drinking water. They don't have access to health care.
Pope warns disease is spreading fast, as is hunger, with one in every two Sudanese struggling to find enough food to survive. Meanwhile, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, condemns the escalating hostilities in Al Jazeera state, which he says is worsening the risk of attacks against civilians. His spokesperson, Saif Magango, says the rapid support forces reportedly have killed hundreds of people amid widespread looting in this region. He says the RSF also reportedly has detained and ill-treated civilians from targeted villages.
Further, there are reports of burning of crops at a time when over 25 million Sudanese are facing acute food insecurity because of the ongoing conflict. Destruction of crops in a region considered the country's breadbasket can only exacerbate an already catastrophic situation.
He says thousands of families reportedly have been displaced from Al Jazeera state because of the violence, adding to the already dire displacement crisis in the country. High Commissioner Turk is calling on leaders of both the RSF and Sudanese armed forces to promptly take measures to de-escalate the situation and to stop rights violations by their forces. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And here are some of the other stories we're following from around the world. Donald Trump says his weekend rally that was marked by crude and racist insults was a love fest. That's the same term he used in reference to the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Given a chance to apologize on Tuesday, Trump instead doubled down, saying it was an honor to be involved. In a report released on Tuesday, the World Health Organization says more than 8 million people were diagnosed with tuberculosis this year. That's the highest number recorded since they began keeping track. It also says that TB has likely returned to being the world's deadliest infectious disease after being replaced by COVID-19. About 1.25 million people died of TB last year. In Argentina, rescue workers are scrambling to reach several people trapped under the rubble of a 10-story hotel that collapsed in the seaside resort of Villa Gazelle. At least one person died when the building, which was undergoing unauthorized renovations, collapsed in the middle of the night. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. And now our daily look at American politics. Farmers are a vital part of the U.S. economy and culture, and it's not uncommon for them to be facing economic headwinds as politics in Washington can affect their business. Government subsidies and international trade tariffs can make or break a farmer's year. VOA's Kane Farbaugh reports from Illinois.
The sun rises daily over a season of uncertainty on John Ackerman's Morton, Illinois farm.
In Illinois, we have over 25,000 acres of pumpkins most years.
Illinois is the top pumpkin-producing state in the U.S., and the crop generates about half of Ackerman's income. He's grown plenty of pumpkins and gourds this year, even amid a drought. But his greatest uncertainty isn't the weather. He's worried about the lapse in funding from major legislation called the Farm Bill.
It provides me the chance to purchase insurance.
Small farmers like Ackerman rely on Farm Bill subsidies to help pay for crop insurance, which helps them secure funding from lenders to keep operating.
If I can't show to them that I can purchase insurance that'll cover me in a disaster, that affects their ability to lend to me.
Crop insurance makes up roughly 10% of the 10-year, more than $1 trillion Farm Bill. Farm Bill funding ended September 30th amid debate among lawmakers over its renewal. Congress is now in recess through the presidential election, the other great source of uncertainty for Ackerman.
Farm income's really going to drop this year.
Ackerman attributes that to high prices for inputs like fertilizer and low prices for his corn and soybean crops. He says prices are low partly because China put tariffs on U.S. soybeans in retaliation for the Trump administration's tariffs on Chinese steel, both of which have continued through Joe Biden's presidency.
China's purchases have dropped off, so tariffs will affect the farmers first.
Debate during the U.S. presidential campaign about more tariffs rattles Ackerman and Streeter, Illinois farmer David Iserman.
It scares me.
As Iserman processes grain products harvested from his fields, he's debating whether to sell the crops now or store them and hope for better prices. But he worries about the long-term damage of tariffs.
We lost that soybean market to China, to South America.
We need new markets. We need markets to ship these crops to.
Ryan Whitehouse is director of national legislation for the Illinois Farm Bureau, which advocates for farmers to lawmakers.
Making sure that tariffs are not imposed is a top priority for this organization.
Iserman says the trade war with China affected more than just crop prices.
It raised prices probably on a lot of equipment because prices went up on steel and aluminum, and there's a lot of steel, aluminum, and farm equipment.
The Trump administration gave farmers additional subsidies to offset the effects of tariffs, but they didn't cover all of Iserman's losses.
I don't know that it made us whole.
But it's always good to have a good year.
Ackerman hopes whoever wins the White House this year, as well as seats in the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate, keeps farmers in mind.
Are we well represented? I don't think so, to be honest.
Both Iserman and Ackerman say passing the farm bill as soon as possible is critical, regardless of which party leads the government after Election Day. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Morton, Illinois.
Experts say small modular reactors, called SMRs, are bringing affordable nuclear energy to less wealthy countries. But what are SMRs, and why are proponents so excited about them? VOA reporter Henry Wilkins has the story.
This Vienna conference in late October is the first one held by the UN nuclear watchdog that focuses on small nuclear reactors known as SMRs. Rafael Mariano Grossi, the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, says less developed countries have signed deals to build the SMRs that will give them nuclear power for the first time.
The small and modular reactors, one of the most promising, exciting, and necessary technological developments that we have had coming for quite a long time, but that we know now that is going to be a reality.
This year, Ghana and South Africa signed deals with firms to build their first SMRs. Others are already operating in China and Russia, and others are set to be built in Argentina, Canada, Britain, and the United States. But what are SMRs, and how can they help the less wealthy countries access nuclear power? SMRs are miniature nuclear power plants with an electricity output about one-third that of regular nuclear plants. They're cheaper because of their smaller size and because they're factory-built. They require less upfront investment, making it more affordable for smaller economies to get nuclear power. Modular parts make the small reactors easier to alter and upgrade, and less expensive to maintain. Experts say because of these things, SMRs have the potential to transform economies. African nuclear physicist Senamil Masango says the African continent, where power outages are common, is crying out for energy solutions like SMRs.
We need instant solution to address the energy security. As you know, that energy is the center of the economy. So this energy scarcity or the energy challenges that are faced in Africa, it kills our economy.
But critics argue that countries should focus on renewable energies such as wind and solar, which don't carry the environmental risk of nuclear power and don't produce radioactive waste. Ed Lyman, Director of Nuclear Safety at the Union of Concerned Scientists, warns SMRs don't benefit from the same economies of scale as larger nuclear power plants. He says his analysis of one company's SMR shows customers can end up paying five times more when compared to larger plants for the electricity they produce. Because of the higher generation costs, he says, operators might have to limit expenses and run a higher safety risk.
There's just too much pressure to cut costs in other ways, for instance, by reducing the number of operators.
Lyman also said a strong independent national regulator is essential for avoiding nuclear incidents, and that it's not always clear how SMR deals will be financed. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
Religious political parties in Bangladesh have become active in national politics since Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina's ouster this past summer. VOA's Sarah Zaman reports from Dhaka.
In a narrow alley of Dhaka, Bangladesh's capital, workers renovate the headquarters of Jamaat-e-Islami that was shut down in 2010. The country's biggest religious political party, Jamaat, was delisted and kicked out of electoral politics in 2013 when former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina was in power. Days before her ouster in August this year, Hasina fully banned the party in a bid to stop the mass uprising against her. With Hasina now gone, Jamaat is back in mainstream politics. Party Secretary General Mia Ghulam Parwar wants the interim government of Nobel Peace Prize winner Muhammad Yunus to call elections soon.
We feel they should take neither too long nor too little time to announce the next elections. The period of time should be reasonable.
As Jamaat and other religious groups resume political activities, some worry Bangladesh may tilt to the right. Political analyst Zahidur Rahman disagrees. He points to the poor results of Jamaat's few electoral runs as proof that Bangladeshis prefer secular politics.
So there's some rightist elements, but the major political force in our country is still centrist force. Even Jamaat didn't have that much traction. So you might find them very vibrant in social media, on the streets, but their popular support is not that high.
Still, the religious right is affecting decision-making in Bangladesh. In September, the interim government dissolved a school curriculum review committee amid pressure from Jamaat and other religious groups to include Islamic scholars. Transparency International Bangladesh condemned the government's decision. Attacks on Hindus and their places of worship since Hasina's ouster have also raised fears of a rise in religious extremism. But minority rights advocate Gobinda Pramanik rejects such concerns.
The attacks were political, not a religious hate attack at all.
Minorities also faced attacks when Hasina's party, Awami League, was ruling the country. More than 91% of Bangladeshis are Muslim. Islam is the state religion, but the constitution upholds secularism. Porwar says his party wants equal rights for citizens of all faiths.
That said, since this is a Muslim-majority country, the state will have certain responsibilities owing to the protection of the values, culture, and religion of the Muslims.
Religious parties may have gained political space in Bangladesh since Awami League's ouster, but their popularity will be tested whenever Bangladeshis go to polls. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Dhaka.
And finally, today with Halloween just a day away, increases in the price of chocolate have forced candy makers to make other plans, leaving chocoholics feeling tricked and not treated. Lisa Bernard of Reuters has more.
Trick-or-treaters hoping to collect handfuls of chocolate candy this Halloween may be greeted with gummy bears instead. Blame elevated chocolate prices due to both pandemic-era supply chain snarls and a current cocoa bean shortage, which have led to shrinking corporate margins and slower sales. As a result, famous chocolate brands have doubled down on cheaper non-chocolate treats this Halloween, such as Hershey's new Jolly Rancher Ropes and Shackalicious Gummies, the latter inspired by former basketball star Shaquille O'Neal. Market research firm Circana said the shift comes as prices on seasonal chocolate candy have increased by as much as 7.5% from last year. That's prompted Hershey to tweak even some of its most famous chocolate brands, with Halloween offerings that also include Reese's Werewolf Tracks, which feature a vanilla cream top instead of milk chocolate, and a Kit Kat Ghost Toast with a cinnamon toast flavored cream. Mondelez, which does not have a major U.S. chocolate brand, said shoppers are also looking for more limited editions and special flavors, such as its Sour Patch Kids Apple Harvest and Cherry varieties. Privately held Mars did not reply to a request for comment. Still, this bounty of gummy candy may not stick, as Circana said that non-chocolate treats, while cheaper, have also risen in price.
That's Lisa Bernard of Reuters with that story for us. And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. From Washington, I'm Steve Karish.